This is the late, great Fela Kuti with a piece called Monkey Banana, an animal tune of sorts, as we ease into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. For more information about the show and past guests, as well as archives and iTunes podcasts, I invite you to visit our website, talkinganimals.net. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Dr. Carol Noon, founder director of Save the Chimps, the world's largest sanctuary for rescued chimps, located right here in Florida, occupying 200 acres in the Fort Pierce area. So we'll find out more about Save the Chimps, including the background of the chimps that live there, how most are relocated from another Save the Chimps location in New Mexico, and what their lives are like now, when we speak with Dr. Carol Noon in a few moments here on Talking Animals. As usual, we'll also, of course, welcome your questions and comments to be in on that conversation with Dr. Noon at 813-239-9663, or email us at dj@wmnf.org. So we always like to do quickly want to hit a little bit of animal news and or announcements, and fortunately, is yet another ripple effect of these tough economic times. There's a dog sanctuary slash hospice closing, simply just not getting enough donations to be able to continue to feed and care for the dogs there. So they are still actually a 501c3 charity and can receive donations until the end of the calendar year, until December 31st, 2008. Meanwhile, there are a lot of animals that need adopting. But to find out more, and these are all spayed or neutered, by the way, all their vaccinations are current, and the property is for sale. So for more information and pictures of the animals and questions, you can email kk5034@msn.com or simply call 352-680-1707 and see if you can help out these animals and give them a home. And also, just if nothing else for the phrase, although long-time Talking Animals listeners know we love this place regardless of whatever phrase they're using, but I'm speaking of the Animal Coalition of Tampa and a cool special they're running in September under the phrase, neuter is cuter. And so they've got a really great deal. We can't get into the specifics the way we do our radio here about the prices and stuff. But it's always great over there, and you can simply just go to actampa.org or call 813-250-3900 and find out about some low-cost neuter and some other things that they've got going. So yay to them. All right, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. This is Brian Regan with a piece called Whale Noises on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I saw this documentary recently on whales. This guy has dedicated his life to telling you what the whales are saying. Wow. I don't know how you'd argue with him when he turns in his report. And he just throws it down there. Well, here's what the whales are saying. Okay, thanks, Charlie. He's looking back. Here's what the whales are saying. Yeah, Charlie figured it out. They show how he does it. He's out on a ship. He's got a pencil, and he deciphers the whale noises as he hears them. You know, he'll hear like, you know, he's like, oh, okay. Oh, he's lonely. No, you're lonely. I'd like to do that for like 2 weeks and then turn around and find out that the door's squeaking behind you.
All right. That was Brian Regan with a piece called Whale Noises, taken from his album simply entitled Live. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. Where not only all our past programs are archived, but most are now available as podcasts in iTunes. For example, our last show with Second Chance for Pets Amy Schieber, and the one before that with Richard Belzer. We also have a link to the Talking Animals MySpace. We're looking for friends. And there's a place to subscribe to our semi-monthly email newsletter so we can keep you posted on forthcoming guests, program news, and more. That's all at talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to speak with today's guest, Dr. Carol Noon. So let me quickly outline a few important details about her. As I mentioned a moment ago, she is the founder and director of Save the Chimps, the world's largest sanctuary for rescued chimpanzees. The organization's primary location is a sprawling 200-acre facility in Fort Pierce, Florida, which currently houses about 140 chimps, and the population will ultimately be closer to 300 as more and more chimps are relocated from the New Mexico facility. Before reaching retirement in this idyllic Florida setting, that Save the Chimps has provided, these animals spent years, decades in some cases, in research labs, the entertainment world, and the pet trade. So there's clearly much to discuss here. With a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Dr. Carol Noon to Talking Animals. Dr. Noon?
Yes.
How are you? Welcome to Talking Animals.
Thank you, Duncan.
So, of course, we'll want to quickly delve into Save the Chimps and what the lives of these chimps were like before and after they arrived at your sanctuary. But first, I guess I'd just like to ask, what first drew you to working with chimps?
I was an undergraduate student at Florida Atlantic University in Boca.
Oh.
And Jane Goodall came to the university and gave a lecture about chimps, and I sort of took it from there.
Wow. So, and what were your studies at that point? I mean, how much of a sort of instant transformation was this?
Well, I was an undergraduate biology student, and then I went on to grad school in primatology as a result.
And really just largely from just that one time of hearing Jane Goodall speak?
Well, actually, she kind of inspired me, and then I met my first chimpanzees and sort of fell in love.
So there's a combo. Jane Goodall and a chimp, of course. There's your path, right?
Yeah.
So, well, at a couple points in the show, including a moment ago when I introduced you, I briefly mentioned the two Save the Chimps locations, but I think it'd be quite useful for you to tell us about the New Mexico facility and the Colston Foundation and the Florida facility, of course, and how those two locations kind of function in concert at this point.
Well, the Florida facility was born out of a lawsuit against the Air Force when the Air Force gave their 141 chimpanzees to the Colston Foundation. So I sued the Air Force, and as an out-of-court settlement, got 21 of those chimps. So I bought the property in Florida. I had plans to grow very gradually. I certainly never anticipated where I am today. And about a year after the first chimps arrived here, I got a call from Fred Colston saying that he wanted to retire and that he wanted to retire the chimps. So after about 6 months of negotiations, we took over the New Mexico lab, which was probably the worst lab in the history of the Animal Welfare Act.
And how so? Well, I mean, I've seen that phrase many a time, but just for our listeners and my own sake, I'm curious to know what that really means. I mean, you know, we don't have to go into all kinds of gruesome detail, but just some examples.
It means that you, in many cases, lived alone in a cage with nothing, just an empty cage. You got a diet of dry monkey chow, which is like dry dog food, twice a day, and water. And your cage was sprayed from the outside. Nobody ever went in and scrubbed it, so the place stunk.
Mm.
Chimps are like us. They're very social. They've got great big brains. They need to keep busy. And these chimps were basically in solitary confinement.
Yeah, with no stimulation, really.
Mm-hmm.
So you took over the New Mexico facility. Maybe sort of walk us through kind of what's happened in the ensuing period.
Well, we took over New Mexico and made it livable. We did about $500,000 worth of renovations and started forming social groups. And simultaneously, we turned Florida into a construction site. We built 11 new islands and buildings, and we started migrating the chimps from New Mexico to Florida. So we're about halfway through.
And I think it'd be really interesting to sort of hear about how that works, not necessarily strictly the logistics of the relocation, although I think that's interesting too. But I guess what's also interesting is how first you seem to try to form chimp groups in the New Mexico facility before they're relocated to Florida. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, there were so many chimps that we were able to form what I call communities or families with old men and women adolescents. We had 11 babies when we took over, so every group got a baby. They're no longer babies. Now they're adolescent, hard-to-handle kids.
Mm-hmm.
So the social groups range in size from 19 to maybe 27. So we move them as a group to Florida, and then we can take 10 at a time. So sometimes it takes 3 trips to get them all here. And then once they're all here, we open the doors to the island, and they're free to do what they want to do. Now, some of these people, keep in mind, were born in Africa, so they've been in captivity for 40 years, cement under their feet, always walls around them, always a ceiling over their head. So when you open the door and you say, you know, go, you can imagine what kind of courage it takes to step out.
Yeah. And are they all pretty much reluctant initially, or some a little more just seeing the opportunity kind of spring into action? Or
they push each other out of the way trying to get out the door.
I'll bet. Yeah. Here's our chance.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And when those groups are formed, or even maybe when they land in Florida, is there, with that number of chimps, just like with any of us, are there sort of reconfiguring that needs to be done with maybe a certain personality or a certain type or a behavior that just doesn't fit in that particular group? Or how does that work?
Well, you're absolutely right, Duncan, and I actually hadn't anticipated this. What happens is you move a group that lives in relatively small cages out to an island, a 3 to 5 acre island. So when you're all crammed together in an inner city and somebody talks bad about your mom, you kind of tolerate it because you don't have a choice. Well, what happens is they come here, and somebody gives you a hard time. Now you don't have to take it. You can smack them and run away. So what often happens is the dynamic changes, and we have to remove one or two people who don't work out in their group anymore.
I see. And then are those people, those chimps, when they get moved into a different group, is it just kind of there's enough difference in the composition of that new group where they then could fit in, and or do they have to kind of keep relocating and be sort of the difficult child?
Most cases, they only need to be relocated once.
Mm-hmm.
The difficult child syndrome is usually those chimps that have come from private ownership,
yeah,
as a pet, or from the entertainment industry. Those are the really hard cases because those are the ones that they either were raised without other chimps or they were raised thinking they weren't chimps.
Right. So that whole socialization or even just any kind of self-awareness was sort of scotched from the get-go.
Correct.
All right, let me just let our listeners know this is Talking Animals. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. Carol Noon, founder and director of Save the Chimps, the world's largest sanctuary for rescued chimpanzees. Key location right here in Florida in Fort Pierce. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Dr. Noon a question, please call 813-239-9663, or you can email us a question or comment at dj@wmnf.org. So I want to touch on, the entertainment, you know, path to save the chimps or even the private ownership. But I guess first, just I'm sort of interested to know, and I guess in the sort of interest of striving to be fair about putting the first part of this in context, I mean, were what portion of the research efforts, whether by Colston or anyone else that maybe has been a source of some of these chimps, actually yielded some results that have had some important positive medical implications for humans?
The answer to that depends on who you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
But if you make a rule that let's make a rule that all chemotherapy must be tested on chimpanzees before it's used in humans, and then they go on to the clinical trials in humans and it works, then you can, by extrapolation, say chimpanzees were vital to the development of chemotherapy. The rule could have been elephants or children under the age of 3.
Mm.
It just depends on what the rule is. So given the rule that chimps have to be used, then you can stand back and give them credit for all kinds of breakthroughs in medical research.
I see. So again, it sounds like it depends on who's making the rules and who's interpreting them.
Right. Now, in the early 80s, chimpanzees were chosen as the model for HIV.
Yeah, I really wanted to ask about this, yeah.
And so there was a real vamping up of the breeding program. They spent $40 million. They started breeding chimps because they were going to be the answer. Well, chimps can carry the virus in their systems, but they don't get sick and die of it.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly, there are all these HIV-infected chimpanzees that aren't dying like they were supposed to. So now there's all sorts of overcrowding in the labs.
But also, isn't the other part of that, at least implicitly, that what can you possibly learn when you've got a chimp that has that, but they don't manifest the symptoms that you're supposedly trying to research?
Exactly. And what even complicates it even more is that the protocol for infecting a chimp with HIV is they should have already been through hepatitis research.
Mm.
So they don't, in the industry, they don't use what are called clean animals. So that further complicates things.
Yeah, and it just sounds like then most of these, at least that we're talking about now, are just sort of profoundly ill-conceived because you can't, you know, even if you went along with and your interpretation of the rules you just mentioned earlier where, hey, this is okay to do, it's not going to yield anything of any medical value.
Well, that seems to be the case.
She said in a very understated fashion. Okay, so here's an email question, Dr. Noon. I read about public university labs still using chimpanzees. What can we do about this? Also, she says here, do you accept donations of toys for your chimps? Thank you for your amazing work.
The first question, there are still about 1,200 chimpanzees in laboratories right now.
Mm.
And the second question was, do we accept donations of toys? We do. But remember those little babies that I talked about that grew up?
Yeah.
Well, we have had to ban toys on the islands because what these little, now they're 7 and 8 years old, what they think is fun is to wait until a 40-year-old's back is turned and then throw a toy piano at them.
Wow.
Yeah, and then run. And, of course, these old guys haven't got the wherewithal to catch them, so there's no repercussions for their behavior.
Mm.
So what we've done in Florida is we only accept stuffed animals that bounce off old people's backs.
I see. All right, the soft landing stuff. So I guess, because I wanted to mention this a few times anyways, the website is savethechimps.org and all kinds of great info, and I guess from there people could find out where to, if they were inclined to send off some stuffed animals or soft things, that's where they could find out how to do so.
Yes, we have a wish list.
Great.
Actually.
Okay. Now, having just answered the email question about the public university still, you know, doing that kind of research and the Colson thing that we touched on, I guess I'm really interested to know, you know, with the chimps that were used in, you know, various forms of biomedical research, what sort of changes do you observe in their behavior or temperament as they log more and more time in that sort of idyllic Florida setting that they now reside in?
We didn't even have to wait to move to Florida for this to manifest itself. What happens is you walk in and there's a chimp alone in a cage, been there for 40 years, rocking back and forth, just staring off into space, dying of excruciating boredom. And you start giving them blankets so they can make nests or toys to play with. And then you start introducing to one chimp and another chimp, and pretty soon they're part of a group. What's so remarkable is there are no lost causes. There's nobody who's gone so far into the deep end that they don't come back.
Wow, well, that's really striking and sort of almost pointed, just, you know, having known, and I think as probably most people that are listening would, some of the really awful things that these chimps have undergone.
Yeah, and that's why when we opened the door, the first time we opened the door, I told the staff, don't be surprised if nobody goes out, and they all ran out. You know,
wow.
They're ready to get on with their lives.
Sure, sure. And I guess that also brings me to another point, which is that you know, you've talked about how, you know, these chimps were as babies, or maybe in some cases still are. But I think it's really interesting and maybe puts things in a different context to understand, too, what baby chimps are like as opposed to chimps that become older, and what kind of risks, you know, in whatever situation you would somehow find yourself around an adult, a grown chimp, as a human, what sort of risk that would pose?
Well, one of the things people say when they come out here is they had no idea chimps were so big, and that's because most of us are just exposed to the chimps that we see on TV and in the movies,
mm-hmm.
and most of those chimps are either babies or maybe 6 or 7 years old. After that, they get too strong to safely handle, and they're then retired more or less from their working life.
Yeah.
And those babies are adorable, and they go on television shows and sit on the host's lap, and they're cute as can be. But the reality is that they turn out to be 150-pound, 5-foot, 10 times stronger than us chimps.
Yeah, and it's just the power is just, I mean, you know, every so often, unfortunately, you read about something, you know, where a human has gotten into contact with a chimp like that and something goes awry. And the sheer power, and unfortunately, the severity of the injuries are just shocking sometimes.
Well, what's most interesting is of the attacks on humans by chimpanzees that have been the most violent, all of those chimps, the recent attack in California happened a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
If you're thinking about that one, those were entertainment chimps. Those chimps were raised by humans.
Yeah. And what is that? What is that? I mean, take me one step further. What does that mean that because of how they were trained, they have more sort of at least the potential kind of bubbling underneath the surface for that kind of explosive attack as opposed to another chimp with another kind of history?
Duncan, I have no idea what it means, but it's more than a coincidence that all incredibly violent attacks are done by chimps raised by humans, and I don't know why. I don't know what the common thread is, but it's got to be something.
Yeah, well, like you say, it's more than just coincidental, so there must be, because, yeah, I mean, that attack, I was thinking of that one in particular, and that just seemed, you know, just so vicious.
Those chimps were in movies.
Yeah. Yeah, they were just sort of in a retired sanctuary out in Southern California, or sanctuary in quotes, perhaps, but... and speaking of sanctuary and the real McCoy and things that are only just calling themselves sanctuary, I mean, by their very nature, most genuine sanctuaries are not open to the public, and Save the Chimps falls into this category. Maybe for those who might not understand fully why, maybe you could explain that a bit.
Sure. This was a question that I grappled with. We all did in the beginning, because certainly if you're open to the public, you can charge admission and make some money off the gate.
Sure.
But if I stand there at the gate charging you admission and say, look what we've done, we've rescued chimps, we've retired them, and we've rescued them from exploitation, please form a single file so you can go stand in front of their cages and gawk at them.
Mm-hmm.
Something's wrong there.
Yeah, you're stepping into the entertainment biz, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So people can, you know, sort of enjoy, again, the website, and there's been some great documentaries. And
there's a lot of video on our website, so you can see the chimps.
Right.
They just can't see you.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. With that sort of difficult, but obviously, you know, the right decision for the chimps of not making it open to the public and therefore not, as you say, getting money at the gate. How is Save the Chimps funded? I mean, you know, obviously this must involve tremendous expense between the two locations and all the chimps and all their food and things. I mean, how does that work?
Our budget is about $3.5 million a year, and almost 90% of that, probably 80% of that, goes directly to the chimps' care. And we raise our money on donations and foundations.
And I imagine, given the background of some of these chimps and how they were used, you're probably opposed to accepting certain kinds of other funding that might maybe compromise your independence or control of those chimps.
I don't even know what other funding there is out there.
Well, I just didn't know if there was, you know, certain kinds of, you know, government or other funding, but you know, potentially with some sort of strings attached or with just things that, you know, you wouldn't retain the total kind of independence that you have now. But that's just a lot of money, and this Arcus Foundation sounds like it's really been a godsend.
It certainly, I mean, if it hadn't been for them, these chimps would be sitting in Alamogordo today living life just like they lived it 10 years ago. And 10 years from now.
Wow. Well, I think we're just sort of nearing the end of our time. I'm going to try to squeeze one quick question in. Hi, you're on WMNF with Dr. Carolyn. We have time just for a very, very brief question.
Okay, I have a question about volunteering.
Mm-hmm.
I just dropped my daughter off at Bennington College up in Vermont, and they have a program where every student every year has to do a field work term, interning or working somewhere for 7 weeks from January 1st to February 22nd. And we have a lot of interesting places in Florida for students who are interested perhaps in biology or anthropology, you know, marine biology, things like that. I told the school that I would make a list of organizations and sanctuary-type places that might be interested in having some student interns for 7 weeks. Would that interest you?
Yes, it would, but I'm not the person who handles that. If you just would check out our website at SaveTheChimps.org, you can email us, and the proper person will get in contact with you.
So the proper person would be a volunteer coordinator that I would see?
Yes.
Okay, good. So what I'm going to do then is I will send your email, your website, to the school and say make a contact then.
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call, and that's a great note to end on, because as with, you know, virtually any sorts of these organizations or sanctuaries, there is, as I understand, at least quite a good-sized volunteer contingent at Save the Chimps, helping prepare the food for all these cool residents, et cetera. So that's a great place to end it. So, Dr. Kellman, I wish we'd had more time to talk about more things, but thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. And, again, the website is SaveTheChimps.org, and thanks for all your wonderful work on behalf of these chimps.
Oh, you're very welcome, Duncan. Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.